The motion is adopted.
A massive tax and spending bill is now heading for President Trump's signature.
We look at what the package will mean for Americans this Thursday, July 3rd, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, a closer look at who's being detained and deported by the Trump administration.
How does the data square with the president's claim that he's focusing on violent criminals?
Tom Homan and Stephen Miller, they're saying they're going after the worst of the worst. That's just not what the data say about the people that they're arresting.
Also, what happens now to the business empire of hip-hop mogul Sean Combs?
And the origins of the word barbecue.
The word barbecue actually was a wooden frame that the Taino people would use to slow cook their meats.
After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. By a narrow margin, the House today voted to approve President Trump's massive domestic policy bill, which includes around $4.5 trillion in tax cuts for the wealthy and $1.2 trillion in cuts to government spending, including Medicaid and food assistance. As President Trump was about to board a plane to head to Iowa for a speech tonight, he praised it.
I think when you go over the bill, it was very easy to get him to a yes. You know, we went over that bill, and point after point, biggest tax cut in history, great for security, great on the southern border, immigration is covered. We covered just about everything.
Republicans had to overcome opposition within the party to approve the bill before Trump's self-imposed deadline of July 4th. That's tomorrow. No Democrats voted for the bill. Meanwhile, ahead of today's vote, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries delivered the longest leadership speech in the history of the House. NPR's Elena Moore reports.
The speech lasted 8 hours and 44 minutes, surpassing then-House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy's record from 2021. Each used what's called the magic minute, which lets House leaders speak for as long as they want. So before the vote, Jeffries gave a final rebuke of the spending bill and pledged to stay on the offensive.
No matter what the outcome is on this singular day, we're going to press on.
Throughout his speech, Jeffries read letters from Americans who say they'll be harmed by cuts to social safety net programs. Many, he said, came from Republican-controlled districts. Elena Moore, NPR News, The Capitol.
Tennessee now explicitly protects in vitro fertilization and the right of women to use contraception. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN in Nashville reports the state becomes the first in the South to protect IVF and birth control.
In just a few paragraphs, Tennessee's new law codifies the right to IVF and contraception. Many GOP lawmakers fought against its protections of genetic testing and the morning after pill. Republican Iris Rudder sponsored the legislation, which barely passed.
As you listen to some of the discussions on this House floor this morning, maybe you can understand why. This is very important to codify into law the rights of women to continue to access IVF and contraceptives.
Tennessee acted after the Supreme Court in neighboring Alabama effectively shut down fertility treatment. Alabama has since granted immunity to IVF clinics, but does not codify fertility treatment as a right. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
The Labor Department says 147,000 jobs were added in June, more than economists were expecting, and job gains for April and May were revised up by a total of 16,000. Meanwhile, the unemployment rate dipped last month to 4.1% as the number of people looking for work or working shrank. You're listening to NPR News. Air pollution may be more harmful than exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke. That's according to a study published in Nature this week. NPR's Jonathan Lambert has more.
Lung cancer is usually thought of as a problem for smokers, but up to 25% of cases occur in people who've never smoked. To understand why, researchers analyzed lung cancer tissue from 871 non-smokers around the world. While exposure to secondhand smoke was associated with some genetic changes that increase risk of cancer, air pollution turned out to be a bigger player. Non-smokers living in areas with the worst air pollution had nearly four times as many genetic changes previously linked with tobacco smoking and showed higher levels of other cancer-driving mutations. As air pollution increases across many low- and middle-income countries, non-smokers could become increasingly at risk of developing this deadly disease. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Congress is considering several bills that, if passed, would reform the Federal Emergency Management Agency. President Trump has said FEMA, as it currently exists, should be eliminated. The agency is responsible for responding to major disasters, including hurricanes, earthquakes, and wildfires, but has long struggled to help survivors of those disasters. One of the new bills would make it easier for rural towns to get FEMA assistance and also access to federal money for preventative measures. Another one proposes more drastic changes, including making FEMA a cabinet-level agency that would report directly to the president. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Callier, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. President Trump's massive tax and policy bill is now set for him to sign into law. House Republicans won over internal opposition from both moderates and fiscal conservatives to rally enough votes to overcome Democratic opposition. The final vote was this afternoon. The package is basically the president's entire domestic agenda. It makes Trump's 2017 tax cuts permanent and also adds spending for immigration enforcement and defense. That would be partly financed by cuts to Medicaid and clean energy, among other programs, though the package is expected to add trillions to the federal debt over the next decades, the federal deficit, rather. Our correspondents are following what happened in Congress and the White House and what it would mean for Americans. Let's begin with NPR's Deirdre Walsh, who covers Congress. Deirdre, it was unclear until today whether the House would pass the latest version of this package. How did they get there?
President Trump was really the closer. You know, there were as many as a couple of dozen House Republicans who threatened to vote no on this after the Senate passed the bill earlier this week, unless they got changes. Conservatives complained it added to the deficit. Moderates warned that there were steeper Medicaid cuts in it that would harm their constituents. But Speaker Johnson said earlier today that Trump worked the phones. He had many members over to the White House. He got cabinet secretaries involved. But in the end, none of these members got any changes to the bill that passed. They voted for the same bill they spent days railing against. Some suggested the president could use executive actions to tweak how the bill is implemented, but the speaker admitted he didn't really know how that would work. You know, these Republicans made a political calculation after a ton of political pressure from both the White House and the Republican base to get in line with Trump, and they did. With the exception of two Republicans who voted no, Tom Massey of Kentucky and Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania.
So that's the view from Congress. Now let's turn to White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram. Deepa, this is clearly a win for President Trump. What can you tell us about his influence on the process?
Yeah, well, according to the White House, the president was deeply involved in the process. He was holding calls with lawmakers, like Deirdre said, who were on the fence about this. And they described, you know, Trump's relationships with lawmakers that he's built since being in office as helping a, quote, cascade of support come together in the end. And, you know, Deirdre had also just mentioned Representative Tom Massey. That's kind of a good example here of someone who didn't really get in line with Trump and behind Trump on this bill. He said that he wasn't going to vote for the legislation. And ever since then, the president has been posting about Massey on Truth Social, which is his social media platform, saying he's going to support a primary challenger for that seat in Kentucky. And so, you know, if whether it was online, through the phones, there was definitely just a lot of influence from the president in this process. Even yesterday, he was posting online saying to Republican members, quote, it should be an easy vote. So a very heavy-handed Trump in this process.
Some of the reservations from members of Congress come from the fact that a lot of voters and constituents have reservations about it. How does President Trump plan to overcome that?
Well, the interesting thing about Trump in that regard is that he's not running for re-election, right? So he doesn't really have to answer to voters here. So answering those concerns might fall more on Republican members who have to go back to their home districts, face their constituents about some of these issues. And the big one there, Ari, is changes to Medicaid, which is the health insurance program for lower income Americans, the elderly, the disabled. And the fact that there are changes being made to that program in the first place is a violation of a campaign promise that Trump made, which is that he wouldn't touch Medicaid at all. And now under this bill, nearly 12 million people are expected to lose their coverage in the next decade.
Well, let's talk more about the impact this is going to have on Americans. And for that, I want to bring in NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, are Americans going to feel immediate differences once the president signs this bill into law?
This is not going to feel like a windfall to most people because this bill just keeps the 2017 tax cuts in place. Most people's take-home pay is not going to change very much. Taxes that would have gone up will instead stay the same. Now, for those at the top of the income ladder, they will avoid what would have been a pretty sizable tax hit. According to the Tax Policy Center, about 60% of the tax savings in this bill go to the top 20% of earners, that is, people making more than about $217,000 a year. Middle-income families will see a smaller tax break, and those at the bottom of the income ladder may actually wind up worse off because for them, the cuts to safety net programs like Medicaid and food stamps will, on average, outweigh any of their tax savings.
When you put all this together, what are some of the longer-term economic impacts?
Well, you mentioned the bill adds several trillion dollars to the federal debt over the next decade. Another thing it does is put a lot more money into immigration enforcement. So we are likely to see more deportations. The administration's also been closing off legal pathways for people to come into the country. Forecasters at the Brookings Institution and the American Enterprise Institute say we are likely to see a net outflow of immigrants this year and next. That's the first time that's happened in at least six decades. We've already started to see a drop in the foreign-born workforce. Over time, that outflow means there will be fewer workers, fewer people spending money, and overall a smaller economy than we otherwise would have had.
There was strong resistance throughout the entire process about some of the issues that Scott has just described. So, Deirdre, when you look at both Democrats and members of the Republican Party who resisted this strongly, what does it say about opposition to this legislation that it eked out and passed in the end?
I mean, for Republicans, it just shows you the shift in the party under Trump. You know, conservatives in Congress, many of them campaigned on promises to slash the deficit. But we've already talked about how this adds more than $3 trillion to the deficit in the next decade. The fiscal conservative wing of the party just has less power. There are members who tried to warn about the economic fallout of deficits. But the bill also adds $5 trillion more to increase the country's borrowing authority. You know, Republicans used to call for any kind of, you know, reforms to do anything like that. You know, Democrats were very united on this bill and were very focused on the Medicaid cuts. But in terms of Republicans, this debate shows you what happens to Republicans who break with Trump. Those who thought about voting no saw what happened to North Carolina Republican Tom Tillis. He voted against this in the Senate on Saturday. He was attacked by Trump. By Sunday, he announced he wasn't running for re-election.
Yeah, and speaking of re-election, I mean, this is all now about the next election, right? The midterms, 2026. Trump has to sell this agenda and this bill to the American people. And there are now potentially plans for Trump to travel around the country and take a victory lap of sorts to celebrate his agenda getting passed. And, you know, the White House said today they don't have any plans laid out yet, but he'll sign the bill later tomorrow at 5 p.m. on July 4th, Independence Day, which meets that self-imposed deadline that he wanted.
And so as this bill starts to take effect across the country, what are you all going to be looking out for over the next year or so?
I mean, I think the Democrats are really banking on making this issue the central issue in the 2026 midterms. You heard that from Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader who broke the record for the longest floor speech today with the big applause line. He said Project 2026 starts today. But it is worth noting that some of these key provisions affecting Medicaid don't kick in until after the 2026 midterms.
There's a couple other things I think to watch with Trump. I mean, this bill has more funding for immigration enforcement, right? But how the administration goes about doing that work, if immigration raids ramp up, for example, it may not play out as well politically. There's already been some pullback from voters on how the administration has handled immigration crackdown. And also, while this bill focuses so much on Trump's domestic agenda and campaign promises, he's still dealing with a lot of issues on the world stage, right? The Middle East, Russia's war in Ukraine, these recent strikes in Iran. So I'm also kind of curious to see how much of that might overshadow some of Trump's abilities to tout this really big domestic win.
That's NPR's Deepa Shivaram, Deirdre Walsh, and Scott Horsley. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
And a note that elsewhere in today's show, we'll talk with the chair of the Democratic National Committee about the impact of this bill.
This 4th of July, many of us will take part in the time-honored tradition of barbecue. It made us wonder, why do we even call it barbecue? So here's NPR's Jacqueline Diaz with our word of the week.
Maybe you like a nice, juicy burger. Or maybe you prefer some smoked brisket with a sweet barbecue sauce over one with more of a vinegar bite. Regardless of how you take it, barbecue as we know it, with all of its different flavors, has the same origins: the indigenous Taino people of the Caribbean. Here's Michelle Lefebvre with the Florida Museum of Natural History.
The Taino were a really formative group of people that were kind of on that front line of when the Europeans arrived.
Lefebvre oversees the Caribbean Archaeology Collection at the museum. When the Spanish arrived in the Caribbean, they were struck by the Taino's cooking method, which is what the word barbecue is based on. Alexandra Strong is the executive chef of the National Museum of the American Indians Mitsitam Native Foods Cafe. She's also of Taino descent.
The word barbecue actually was a wooden frame that the Taino people would use to slow cook their meats.
Lefebvre says we know today that the Taino had a diverse menu that included a squirrel-like rodent called the hutia, fish, birds, and plenty of spices to add flavor.
Not surprisingly, you know, they enjoyed some really good food.
And the Spanish were big fans of the end result. And they called this method and the food that came out as a result barbacoa. And that became barbecue. And the flavors continued to transform. Strong says that in the U.S., regional characteristics changed flavors of meat and sauces that we still see today. Cooks in Memphis had easy access to molasses brought in by boats on the Mississippi River,
which gave their barbecue sauce, which is tomato-based, a sweetness to it. And so now, you know, Memphis is known for that unique, sweet, savory type of barbecue sauce.
And for the record, Strong says she likes her barbecue with sauce on the side. And regardless of how you like to take your barbecue, as you get ready to bite into the charred, saucy, meaty goodness this 4th of July, take a beat to remember how it all started. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is the set list on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. The day after the 4th of July is a busy one, with all spotlighted shows taking place this Saturday in Walker, Bemidji, Coleraine, and Duluth. Starting things off, the Crop Dusters are playing at the Green Scene Market and Eatery at 11 a.m. in Walker. They are a five-piece country rock band from the Fargo-Moorhead area who are releasing their debut album later this year. They have one single out so far called Northern Lights. In Bemidji, there is a multi-band punk show at the Rail River Folk School with music beginning at 4:30. Seven bands from Bemidji, Duluth, Minneapolis, and Fargo are playing throughout the day, ranging from shoegaze and metal to punk and alt-rock, and including Hollis Sparhawk's Willem Dafoe Fan Club. It's this Saturday in Bemidji at Rail River Folk School. In Coleraine, old-time quartet Sugar on the Roof are playing at Smoke on the Water at 5 p.m. It's the first of a six-show run throughout the Upper Midwest. The Iron Range group, led by Megan Reynolds, will bring an authentic mix of country, swing, jazz, and blues from the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And the final featured show on the setlist this week is the annual Trampled by Turtles Summer Bayfront Concert in Duluth.
Since last year's edition, the Bluegrass Group released the Always Here, Always Now collaboration with Dead Man Winner, and they recently backed up their friend and 2025 Riverfest opener Alan Sparhawk on his latest solo release. Joining the Turtles in Duluth are 2024 Riverfest performer S.G. Goodman and the 2025 Palomino Grant winner Sophie Hiroko. Music begins at 6 p.m. All four shows on the setlist today, again, are taking place Saturday. The setlist is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump is pushing through a mass deportation campaign. He has promised it will be the largest in U.S. history. Well, new data gives us a clearer picture of exactly who is being arrested. Joining us now to break down some of these numbers is NPR immigration correspondent Jasmine Garst. Hi, Jazz.
Hi.
Okay, so right now, how many immigrants are in detention? Do we even know?
Yeah, at least 56,000 people are being held in ICE detention. And according to the Deportation Data Project, which is a group of academics who collect immigration numbers, about half the people in detention don't have criminal convictions. That's close to 30,000 people in detention without a criminal record.
Wow.
Now, I asked UCLA professor Graham Blair, who is one of the directors of the project, what about the other half of the detainees, the ones with a criminal conviction? And he said the most common is traffic violations.
You listen to Tom Homan and Stephen Miller, they're saying things like they're going after the worst of the worst, the people that are murderers. And that's just not what the data say about the people that they're actually arresting.
Hmm. Okay, and just to be clear, Homan is the Trump administration's border czar. Miller is a key Trump aide. So, Jazz, if the idea was to deport criminals, how did we end up with close to 30,000 people in detention who do not have any criminal record?
So in the first few months of this administration, the number of detentions was around the same as during the Biden administration. But recently, there's been this push to detain more people. I mean, there's now a goal of 3,000 arrests a day. According to Professor Blair, the ICE raids in Los Angeles really marked a turning point. More people without criminal records being arrested. Now, I checked the ICE numbers myself. The number of people without criminal convictions in detention nearly doubled in the last month. Hmm. That's where we're seeing the biggest growth.
Interesting. And what has the Trump administration said about this? Is the priority still on violent criminals?
Yeah, I reached out to the Trump administration and received no response. At a press conference last week, the president and Attorney General Pam Bondi said the focus is on violent criminals. But we've also heard that there will be collateral arrests and that being in the U.S. without papers is reason enough for detention and deportation.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about numbers here, but Jazz, I know that you've spent so much time reporting in immigrant communities. And I'm just wondering, like, what are you seeing? What are people telling you?
So about a month ago, I reported on a man in Florida, Pastor Marilio Ambrosio from Guatemala. He also has a landscaping company. He was in the U.S. without papers for about 30 years, no criminal record. And he had something called a stay of removal, which means you check in with immigration officials at least once a year. You let them know you're employed, you haven't committed any crimes. He's been doing that for 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a few months ago, he was arrested and placed in detention. Last night, he was deported back to Guatemala. Now, here's Greg Johns, a neighbor who lives across the street from the Ambrosio family and who voted for President Trump.
I'm not necessarily comfortable with where we're at right now. You're going to take, you know, a community leader, a pastor, a hard-working man. What did you need a number that day?
Well, a Trump supporter who's now not feeling very comfortable. Has public opinion shifted as the Trump administration's immigration crackdown continues, you think?
Yeah. Last year, a Gallup poll found that 55% of Americans wanted less immigration. But a recent poll by NPR with PBS News and Marist shows that 52% of Americans now disapprove of how the president is handling immigration.
That is NPR's Jasmine Garse. Thank you so much, Jazz.
Thanks for having me.
As the intelligence community continues to assess the impacts of military strikes launched against Iran's nuclear facilities, the CIA is holding up a mirror to its past. They're looking back at a report on Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and questioning how it was put together. NPR's Jenna McLaughlin explains.
In May, President Donald Trump's CIA director John Ratcliffe tasked senior CIA analysts with going back in time. He wanted them to review how a team of intelligence community experts concluded that Russia tried to influence the 2016 presidential race, seeking to damage Hillary Clinton and bolster Donald Trump.
It should be clear to everyone that Russia brazenly interfered in our 2016 presidential election process, and that they undertook these activities despite our strong protests and explicit warning that they not do so.
That was then CIA Director John Brennan testifying on Capitol Hill in 2017. The whole scandal that unfurled, since dubbed Russiagate, infuriated Trump. For years, he's called it a hoax. Intelligence officials involved have consistently defended their conclusions and their tradecraft. Congress, government officials, and the media have gone over every detail multiple times over. But now, as a part of a new lessons learned review, CIA analysts are pointing to what they described as a few deviations from normal procedure behind the 2017 assessment. Those include the close involvement in the assessment by senior intelligence officials, including Brennan, the compressed timeline before publication, the smaller circle of experts who were informed about the key intelligence, and the decision to include the since widely questioned Steele dossier, an opposition research paper compiled by a former British intelligence officer. They said those factors could have distracted from the strength of the report's conclusions. Dan Hoffman, a former CIA operations officer and Russia expert, said the review made some valid points, though he told NPR that analysts often work under fast deadlines. He questioned the value of rehashing the 2017 review, especially when so much else is going on in the world.
I don't know why they did this. Who made this decision to go back over something 9 years old?
Ultimately, the authors of the review said the 2017 era conclusions were defensible. But they recommended that intelligence analysts going forward follow strict procedure to ensure future assessments are seen as credible and objective, particularly when the subject matter is controversial or politically charged. Ratcliffe didn't explain the timing of the review, but in a post on social media platform X, he went beyond its conclusions, alleging that former senior intelligence officials had manipulated intelligence and silenced dissent in an effort to, quote, get Trump. Time will tell how those lessons learned will be incorporated into the CIA's ongoing work. That includes assessing the impacts of the recent U.S. strikes on Iranian nuclear sites. Trump has already touted the campaign as a major success, and Ratcliffe published a statement concluding the targets were severely damaged just days after the missiles were launched. If new evidence comes to light, Hoffman, the former CIA officer, wonders whether those assessments will be questioned.
Are they okay if they submit a report that says that we don't know where the 900 pounds of enriched uranium is?
If the nuclear materials remain somewhere in Iran, that would contradict the White House claim that Iran's nuclear program was obliterated. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the Gigazone, a a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic gigazone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. Looking at weather tonight, chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly cloudy, lows around 70.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. If the federal government finalizes the budget reconciliation bill in play, pro-consumer voices in Minnesota warn the changes won't be friendly to monthly bills for energy customers. The analysts point to new findings from the nonpartisan think tank Energy Innovation, which looked at provisions in the Senate version from this week. It says the plan would cause Minnesotans' home electricity costs to rise by 28% over the next decade. Annie Levinson-Felk of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota says that's because Republican lawmakers are poised to eliminate clean energy tax credits while expanding new oil and gas leasing.
If we can't build as much wind and solar and renewables, then we're not just going to be building more gas plants, but running kind of inefficient, more costly gas plants more than we would have to.
Levinson-Felk says many Minnesotans are already struggling with their utility costs. Fossil fuel-linked groups are cheering the proposed measure, including America's Power. They say incentives for renewables are no longer needed and that they're pushing out sources such as coal prematurely. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. St. Louis County is opening a temporary solid waste collection site in the Brimson area for people to dispose of things damaged by recent wildfires. The collection site will be at the old county garage on Highway 44 in Brimson. Beginning this Monday, the site will operate Monday through Saturday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. The county says this site is for wildfire debris only. People not affected by the wildfire should not bring garbage there. Everything will be accepted free of charge. Visit KAXE.org for more information. The University of Minnesota Medical School and Fairview are expanding rural physician training in the state with a new residency program at Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital. The program will train two new family medicine physicians each year. Dr. Tim Peel has been a family medicine physician in Grand Rapids for 24 years and is the residency program director. He says a looming doctor shortage in the U.S. will impact rural places the most.
It's going to help the community of Grand Rapids, but then it's also going to help us with the shortage that we've had, seeing the patients that we're already taking care of, and then we're investing in the future. So this is a pipeline of future physicians to stay and work here or go to other rural areas, hopefully in the region.
Residents will start the three-year program with 1 year of training at MHealth Fairview Woodwinds Hospital in St. Paul, followed by 2 years in Grand Rapids. Peel says the program will give doctors the opportunity to experience the unique challenges that come with practicing in a rural area.
We have patients that come here from International Falls. We have people who may drive an hour to see one of us, and then perhaps they need to see a specialist. A lot of times they struggle to get to Duluth or get to the cities. So we're often managing patients with diseases that are more complex.
Students can start applying to the program in September, with the first cohort set to begin in July 2026. So what's Peel's pitch to young doctors?
I really think that I have the best job in the world. One of the most fulfilling things for me is that I am part of the community where I practice. And I've been here for a long time, and I intend to be here for a long time.
Funding is from a $750,000 three-year grant through the Federal Health Resources and Services Administration. Lakewood Health System in Staples is also a grant recipient and is expected to be the next institution to launch a rural residency in obstetrics. Second Harvest Northland is hosting a public meeting at 1 p.m. Tuesday at the Grand Rapids Food Shelf. The organization says it will share more information about its recent operational changes, which includes the closure of the food bank warehouse in Grand Rapids. They will also discuss planned investments in the local food shelf program. In a statement on social media, the organization says they hope to provide clarity and converse with community members. Whether you live in northern Minnesota or you're visiting for holiday fun, look no further than our huge list of fireworks and parades for Independence Day 2025. You'll find fireworks maps of each region of the Northland and links to more information on what you'll find at local celebrations. Find the list under local events at the top of KAXE.org. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Well, the trial of Sean Diddy Combs is over. Yesterday, a federal jury acquitted Combs of the most serious charges, racketeering, conspiracy, and sex trafficking. But it did find him guilty on two counts of transportation to engage in prostitution. He remains in custody in Brooklyn awaiting sentencing, and each of those counts carries a maximum sentence of 10 years. So where do all the allegations, all the federal charges, all the lawsuits, where does all that leave the famed hip-hop mogul and his longstanding empire now? Well, in a nebulous place. That is, if you ask Sheldon Pierce from NPR Music. He's been writing about the trial and joins us now. Hi, Sheldon.
Hi, Elsa.
So before we even get into that nebulous place, can you just give us a sense of what Diddy's empire was like and how all those business interests were affected the last couple years by all the allegations swirling around him?
So Diddy began as the Bad Boy Records exec in the 90s. He sort of pivoted to reality TV star before branching into fashion with Sean John, becoming a brand ambassador for Diageo and its Ciroc vodka. He started a media company called Revolt and has since started an e-commerce platform called Empower Global. There has been a significant blow to his standing as an entrepreneur and brand ambassador in the nearly 2 years since the lawsuit started. Mm-hmm. He stepped down as chairman of Revolt TV and later sold his stake. 18 brands severed ties with Combs' Empower Global. And as his longstanding partnership with the liquor brand Diageo was ending, the company's lawyer wrote, "Mr. Combs is well aware that these lawsuits make it impossible for him to continue to be the face of anything." So he has really seen his shifting public image affect the way that he does business.
Yeah, and let's talk more about why. Because even though Combs was acquitted of the most serious charges, the trial, it brought to light a lot of details about his personal life that are going to be hard to forget, like his violent behavior. And even though he wasn't on trial for domestic violence, his defense team did not dispute domestic violence claims from the witnesses. So where do you think Combs stands reputationally now after this trial?
Yeah, even with verdicts on the counts of racketeering, conspiracy, and sex trafficking, the more salacious aspects of the quote-unquote freak-offs or marathon sexual encounters Combs is accused of coercing women into will sadly remain the headline for many people. But beyond those details are patterns of violence too disturbing to disregard, involving former girlfriends and employees. Those stories have been put onto the public record and will now sort of follow him wherever he goes.
Yeah, and a lot of those lawsuits against him are still pending at this point, right?
Yes. Well, the lawsuit Cassie Ventura filed in November 2023 set this all in motion and is the one that has been settled. It was settled less than a day later for $20 million. Since then, dozens have been filed alleging rape, physical abuse, and other misconduct from former artists, fans. A lot of that litigation is still pending, and he will face that in the coming months and years.
Well, even with all that said, you wrote that the outcome of this trial may yet leave a door open for a return, which is a really curious sentence to write, Sheldon. How likely do you rate Diddy's chances of one day being welcomed back as an artist?
Well, I don't think it's likely. He still faces nearly 20 years on the federal charges that he was found guilty of. But not being found guilty on the more serious charges means that it's a possibility. Combs has a long history of skirting scandal, rebranding himself, and taking on a new form. More broadly, there were hopes that this case would bring about a kind of Me Too reckoning for the music industry. But now, in the wake of his escape act, it seems like no such reckoning is coming.
That is Sheldon Pierce from NPR Music. Thank you, Sheldon.
Thanks.
President Trump and Russian leader Vladimir Putin spoke by phone for nearly an hour today. Their conversation appeared to focus on the war in Ukraine. The call comes as the Trump administration says it is pausing the delivery of some U.S. weapons to Ukraine. For more, we're joined by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Greg, any details yet on the call between Trump and Putin?
Well, not a lot. The two leaders appeared to press their main points. Trump wants a ceasefire and a quick end to the war. Putin says he wants to address the root causes of the conflict. Now, this readout is actually coming from one of Putin's top aides. Trump has been stressing this position since he returned to the White House in January, and Ukraine has agreed to a ceasefire, but Russia keeps adding conditions, and there's no sign of a truce on the horizon. And when Putin uses the term root causes, he's referring to the Russian position that the West should stop arming Ukraine, that Ukraine should cede territory, and it should never be allowed to join NATO. So it seems both leaders just restated their positions as the war grinds on.
And as I understand, there's been another development this week, too. The Trump administration now says that it is pausing some military aid to Ukraine. So tell us what kind of impact that could have.
Yeah, the administration says this includes a range of weapons, but one in particular that's extremely important. It's the missiles used by the Patriot air defense system. These missiles are used to shoot down the incoming Russian ballistic missiles, and there's really no substitute. The Patriot is a U.S. system, and only the U.S. makes the missiles that go with them. At the Pentagon, spokesman Sean Parnell said yesterday, this is part of a worldwide review of U.S. military assistance. He says the U.S. has to make sure its own stocks don't dwindle too low. Mm-hmm. So this could affect a lot of countries, but the most immediate impact could be Ukraine, which has depended heavily on the U.S. throughout the war.
Now, you've been covering this for a while, and I know that in the past few years, the fighting in Ukraine has intensified over the summer. Are we seeing that now?
Yeah, the air war in particular. For much of the past 3 years, the Russians might fire a few dozen drones and ballistic missiles overnight. In the past couple months, that number has often soared into the hundreds per night. Last weekend, the Russians fired almost 500 drones in a single night and more than 50 ballistic and cruise missiles. Now, Ukraine shoots down or electronically jams most of these drones, but the missiles are the real problem. Ukraine has this small and dwindling number of air defense missiles, and these limited supplies guard key military locations and government sites. Russia tries to exploit this vulnerability in several ways. It's now making more of its own drones so it can fire more, and it consistently targets these civilian areas like apartment buildings that just have little or no protection.
Greg, I want to end by going back to that U.S. weapons pause for a second. The U.S. has been the leading supplier, so does that leave Ukraine with any other options?
Well, some, but they're limited. The Europeans are trying to do more, but it's still pretty piecemeal. Some weapons here, some vehicles there. One good example is a 155-millimeter artillery shell. It's absolutely critical in the ground fighting, and this is one of the weapons the U.S. is pausing, and the Europeans just aren't making enough. Now, Ukraine is making more of its own weapons. The greatest success has been with drones. They make a large number of very effective drones, but it's only one weapon, and they need many others. And one final note, Trump, as we know, can be very unpredictable, and he's often stated his opposition to more aid for Ukraine. But just last week, he met Ukraine's leader, Volodymyr Zelensky, at the NATO summit in the Netherlands. And then he said he was actually open to the possibility of selling weapons to Ukraine.
And NPR's Greg Myrie, thanks for the update.
Sure thing.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A high court in London says Britain's domestic intelligence agency, MI5, failed to adequately explain why it lied repeatedly to UK courts about an informant accused of violence against women. Even though the head of the agency apologized for the false evidence given in court, the ruling raises serious questions about the agency, which focuses on counter-espionage, sabotage, and terrorism. Villa Marx has this report.
Several years ago, a British woman says she faced violent abuse from her partner, a man identified in legal filings only as X.
She became extremely unwell. It had a very serious impact on her mental health.
Kate Ellis is the lawyer for that woman, known in legal proceedings as Beth, who filed a complaint and human rights claim against MI5 in 2022.
One of the features of the abuse in that relationship was that this man, X, boasted to her that he was an MI5 informant, or that he was working for security services in the UK. It was essentially saying that he'd been given a guarantee of immunity and he could do what he liked. This clearly gave him a real sense of entitlement and empowerment.
Britain's public broadcaster, the BBC, had reported on this man's behaviour and his apparent criminal immunity back in 2022. The BBC said a senior MI5 officer had tried to steer reporters away from the story on national security grounds, while confirming the man was indeed an agent. But while fighting Beth's claims, MI5 reps insisted to several judges the agency had never confirmed X's work for them and never would.
MI5 is very controlling about what it allows to come out.
Gordon Carrera spent 2 decades reporting on security services for the BBC and now hosts a podcast called The Rest is Classified.
With this case, MI5 have really gone into the fight over what they call NCND, neither confirm nor deny, which is the principle that they never comment on their agents' identities. And the point of them doing that, they say, is that if they can't protect the identities of agents, then they won't be able to recruit any more, and therefore considerable harm will come to national security.
But confronted with evidence it had discussed X with a BBC reporter, MI5 insisted it never knowingly lied to judges about his work for them. The High Court Wednesday criticised MI5's own investigations into these inconsistencies, instead recommending a third, quote, robust and independent inquiry. It's not the first time agency oversight has fallen short, says Caroline Wilson-Palau from the non-profit Privacy International.
MI5 right now has a variety of oversight bodies overseeing it in the UK, and yet there's still a huge amount of trust placed in the agency to self-report when errors happen, when there are privacy violations, and that trust isn't always well-founded.
The case about an apparently dangerous man working for MI5 could potentially undermine public trust in British intelligence. But as Beth continues pursuing her claim, she wants further answers about her abuser and for lessons to be learned, says her lawyer, Ellis.
When it's been argued, well, what about the rights of women to know and be able to identify this man who may pose a risk to them? That risk has sort of been seen as lesser as the general risk to national security or the risk to this individual of making his identity known. And I'm not sure that that's the right balance.
The government could soon approve the independent investigation the court suggested, leaving an agency that long operated in the shadows confronting an uncomfortable dose of sunlight. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in London.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. KAXE's future is on the line. The U.S. House recently voted to rescind federal funding for public media. The Senate is next. Public media like KAXE brings you fact-checked news, connection to community, and great music. Free to everyone with no paywall. Public radio stations play a critical role in getting timely, accurate emergency information to the public, especially in rural and underserved areas. Proposed cuts will hit rural and tribal stations the hardest. Now's the time. Tell Congress protect the funding that keeps KAXE and stations like us on the air. ProtectMyPublicMedia.org will connect you to your elected officials. Don't forget, your voice matters. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic, with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, welcoming Dr. Carlisle to their team, offering lid and cataract surgery, general eye exams, and more. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. Be vigilant about storm damage scammers. Find a list of verified tree service providers at the Bemidji Chamber of Commerce's Facebook page. We receive support from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities, working toward a future where everyone feels they belong and can thrive. More at northlandfdn.org. Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series Thursday, July 10th at noon. This month, Dr. Daniel Larkin will talk about the invasive starry stonewort. Register at itascawaters.org. And we receive support from Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative committed to community and giving back through scholarships, youth programs, Operation Roundup, and more. Lake Country Power, made by the community, for the community.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Author Honoré Fanon-Jeffers writes about the unique position of Black women in her latest book. She describes what it means to be at the crossroads.
You are at a place where trouble meets possibility. For me, the notion of the crossroads is the notion of intersectionality of Black women.
In Misbehaving at the Crossroads, Honoré Fanon-Jeffers excavates memories of her childhood, including her father's abuse and her mother's challenges in protecting her from it. She also weaves together history, political commentary, and poetry, all centering Black American women. When I spoke with her, I asked her to describe her mother, Dr. Trellie Lee James Jeffers.
Mama was literally born in an abandoned slave shack. She lost an eye in a tragic childhood accident, and she still went on to graduate as valedictorian of her class. She won a scholarship to Spelman College. When she left Spelman, she came back to her hometown of Eatonton, Georgia. And then she and my father married. It was a troubled marriage. And then after Daddy passed away, she went back and she earned a doctorate. So she was really very extraordinary.
You also write a good deal about your father and how, as you put it, he could so easily flicker from kind to cruel. And you wrote that up until you were putting together what became this book, that the memory of your father and his emotional, physical, and sexual abuse continued to affect both your mental and spiritual health. What allowed you to free yourself from that affecting you?
I think what began to happen is that I understood that what he did wasn't right, but I knew he had been a wounded person. And there was no space for him to heal. Because there is this role that Black men are expected to inhabit, stoic, strong protectors. And so when you are forced to inhabit that role, there's no room for your vulnerability. But I remember those horrible arguments, which sometimes were physically abusive, but many times just Daddy just saying horrible things to Mama and her, you know, screaming back and stuff. And my sisters and I would be gathered around the, you know, the vent, and we would hear things. And then he would burst into tears. And there would be this rusty aching in his voice. And I didn't want to feel sorry for him as a little girl, but I did.
Yeah. Your book ends with some journal entries from 2023 after you were caring for your mother who had early dementia. And when we read your entries, we learn about how her consciousness and her tether to the world around her sort of ebbs and flows. What was that time like for you stepping into that caregiving role for her?
It was very difficult. Let me just say this, you know, because there's no halo around my head. Mama and I had been estranged. Mm-hmm. And what I really wanted to do is to bring her comfort and, like, joy during this time. And so Mama had been a modern dancer when she was in college. So we would watch little snippets of the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater. And I would remind her that she had been a dancer.
You also cooked for her, too, I know.
Oh, yeah, that was something. Because it was a running joke in my family that I couldn't cook collard greens.
Mm-hmm.
But I prayed over it. I prayed real, real strong. And then I went on Facebook and I asked some of the sisters, you know, the black women. And then one afternoon, I just took the whole afternoon and I made those collard greens and I made cornbread to go along. And then when I brought it to her, she said, "This pot liquor is excellent." That's the broth of the collard greens. And then I sat, when I left her, I sat in my car and I cried. I was so happy because I just wanted to make my mama happy.
I have to tell you, when I was reading that part of your story, I almost burst into tears because there's nothing that reminds me of home more than eating my mother's greens, and I could never do them justice. So I can imagine the pressure you were feeling to get them right.
So much pressure. It was a lot of pressure.
You know, it occurred to me as I was reading that at the point that you've published this book and written this and revisited all these memories, your mother, your father had both passed. Did that in any way make you feel more free to explore all of this, to write these truths down?
At first, no. But when I took over Mama's care, I would run into complete strangers. And it was almost like the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. I had to just keep talking about how we had been estranged, because I felt so guilty, you know. And then people began to share with me. You know, I hadn't talked to my mama in 3 years. You know, I was abused as a child. And, you know, and it's real interesting, you know, you sharing the most personal details of your life with complete strangers. And so I began to think about, you know, we have a saying in the black church, "Let me encourage you." I don't know if people want to take from my story that, okay, you must reconcile with your parents. Because if somebody had told me that Mama and I would have come together, I would have laughed in their face. Mm-hmm. But I know that I have a joy and a peace that I never thought possible. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
And it's because of that reconciliation. So, you know, maybe.
Honoré Fanon-Jeffers, her book, Misbehaving at the Crossroads, is out now. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world, Learn more at skoll.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. And we receive support from the Grand Rapids Farmers Market, open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Golf Course Road and Pokegama Avenue, offering an EBT double match and many more programs, bringing produce to members of our community. More at grfarmersmarket.org. Weather tonight, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly cloudy, lows around 70. Tomorrow, 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon.
Hello, I'm Nika.